This week on the Design Review, we talk about usability testing, what it is, how to do it, and debunk some of the common myths about it. Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the Design Review. My name is Chris, and John is not here this week. He is very busy right now, writing a book. If you didn't know, he's writing a book called Tragic Design. He wrote a blog post a while back on, what was it called? I'll link it in the show notes. I forgot the title, but it was about how bad the UX design is of certain medical products, and it ended up actually causing a young girl to die. There were probably a lot of things that the design of the software could have done better, and had they fixed it, sure enough, they probably could have saved this young girl's life. But anyways, John's writing a book on this topic, and he is deep in the heart of editing, so he just couldn't make it tonight. I do want to thank him for covering for me last time because I was on a bike trip, which was really good. Highly recommend it if you've never done a bike trip like that where you go camping and everything. It's super fun. Anyways, let's get right to the topic. Today, I'm going to talk about usability testing. Not just usability testing, but also some of the common myths that I've encountered in my work experience, work life, and just some of the things that I've maybe heard or people have talked to me about. So yeah, what is usability testing? This topic has come up a little bit in discussion. I'm not going to go into super hardcore comprehensive detail because there's a lot to talk about if I did that, but I hope that what I do talk about today will be just enough to help you get started. Maybe you can even start thinking about running your own tests yourself and maybe, you know, pick up a little more hardcore literature on it so that you can actually run one. But I do want to cover kind of the high points and the myths and try and address some of those myths. So anyways, what is it? Usability testing is generally, it's qualitative research to measure how easy something is to use. And I say something because it doesn't actually have to be a digital interface, right? You can do usability testing on just about anything, really. It just happens that we in the UX field tend to talk a lot about digital interfaces a lot, since, quote-unquote, software is eating the world, as Marc Andreessen put it many years ago. And so this leads me to myth number one, and that is that quantitative data is more important and more valuable than qualitative. That's a myth. I don't think anyone has actually said that to me outrightly, but I feel like it seems especially true in startups where there's a lot of testing happening, and generally it's A/B testing. People, for whatever reason, just don't seem to believe in qualitative research, or they don't seem to understand how qualitative research fits in with kind of the business practices and the business processes that are going on in the company. And so usually what happens is qualitative research tends to get discussed as sort of a footnote or, you know, just some sort of side thing that people happen to do one time, rather than it being a really critical part of the product development cycle, which is actually really sad. The simple answer to this myth is that if you're not doing both qualitative and quantitative research, you're basically wasting your time. And I say that because there are just simply questions that you need to ask that are just too difficult to quantify by running A/B tests. And it's actually far less efficient to run some sort of multivariate study than to just talk to somebody, right? especially if you're running a, I don't know, there are so many startups out there that are sort of community-based products that are highly, highly engaged with a highly engaged community. It would actually be fairly easy to just reach out to them, start talking to them, ask them questions, develop personas, do all the things that are really good for product development, rather than just to sort of keep everyone at arm's reach and only run A/B tests. In general, my philosophy on this sort of stuff is to use the research method that gets you the answers that you're looking for, rather than to just say, like, we'll just do everything with A/B testing and take this one-size-fits-all approach. Because there are times when qualitative research is not the right tool to use. And, of course, don't do it if that's if that's the case, right? But I know there are people that only look to quantitative research methods as the way to resolve problems. And it's just wrong. Don't do that. There are many different other ways to find the answers that you're looking for. And as long as you know about them and know how to use them in the right way, you'll not only get better results, but you'll be able to get your results more efficiently. Which then leads me to the next myth, myth number two, which is usability testing is only qualitative in nature. This is also not true. You can use usability testing to run really long-term, large-scale studies to quantify lots and lots of details about a product. There's a guy named Jeff Sorrow. He's a well-known expert in usability testing and user research, and he's done himself lots of large studies like this, and he's published lots of papers on this. Definitely look him up. He's an expert, of course, but he's a good subject matter expert to find his literature on, to familiarize yourself with how this type of testing could be used for quantifying things. My personal opinion is I generally don't like running large studies of this nature, because when you actually are trying to quantify something, there are actually easier ways to do it. And one of those ways is like A/B testing. I think you get a lot more mileage out of doing instrumented studies where you're collecting analytics to quantify things. And so to do everything through a moderated study, I just think it takes a lot more time and effort. And having actually participated in a couple large-scale studies like that, it's really taxing mentally to like have to sit through the same feedback over and over when you're pretty much ready to start, you know, iterating on designs. So as I said, pick the method that suits what you're trying to do. I'm not saying don't ever do large-scale studies. I know personally, if I'm ever in the position again to like direct the design process of a team, I probably wouldn't recommend doing these gigantic studies. But, you know, if it works for you, then by all means, go ahead. All right, so how do you run a test? This is probably one of the more fundamental questions, right? How do you actually run a usability test? So tests of this nature are usually moderated by a facilitator with one participant at a time. So this is the typical, the type of process I'm going to describe to you is the fairly standard moderated testing process. There are lots of other usability testing methods. I would encourage you to kind of go out there and research about them a little more if you're really curious to find out absolutely everything there is to know. But generally, what you'll want to do is some sort of moderated study with a facilitator and a participant, and optionally you'll have one or more observers. Tests of this nature are usually run in some sort of lab environment where you do have observers, and I've been in usability labs where they had the one-way mirrors, and you know the observers were on the other side of the glass, and they could see what was happening, but the participants couldn't see into the room. But I've also set up labs differently where, you know, we didn't necessarily have the budget to have a one-way mirror, so you just work around it. There's a lot of technology that exists today where you can do screencasts or screen recording, or you know, you could webcam it, or there are lots of other ways around this whole one-way mirror thing that doesn't actually require, you know, the installation of like some special glass in a wall. So, you know, it's 2015, right? We should have lots of cool technology by now. Yesterday was Back to the Future Day. Where's our hoverboards, right? Anyways, I digress. So the lab stuff. So that actually leads me to myth number three, which is you need to have lots of complex and expensive machinery to run a usability test. That's false. It's very true that there are a lot of people that like looking at data and then quickly ignore it. Ha ha ha. But no, the people like looking at data and having lots of equipment like eye tracking and, you know, heart rate monitors and I don't know what else you could do to like instrument a study, but you know, having all that equipment to measure all those details, they can certainly provide you with lots and lots of contextual information about what's happening and really help you understand kind of the emotional states of the participant in the test and really understand their frustration levels as they struggle to resolve a particular problem. But in reality, you really don't need a super heavily instrumented testing lab to do a good job. I mean, you just don't need it. Personally, I just don't believe in having that much instrumentation because you can actually do a pretty good job with just a camera, right? You can, the bare minimum basically is just having some way to record what's going on. I've even done really, I mean, granted these were fairly informal tests, but I've even gotten by with just doing an audio recording in voice memos. Like it was sufficient enough for me to record the dialogue, take notes, and just by memory alone, I was able to recall all the details and stuff like that. So definitely record your test sessions. I'm not saying don't record it, but do you need to go to the expense of buying like all kinds of fancy gear and 4K cameras or whatever? No, you don't. I would definitely focus on speed and efficiency as part of your test process because in the grand scheme of things, it's better to test more frequently than testing fewer times with being trying to be totally thorough and like super detailed with all the contextual data. It's just you can get what you need by, you know, fairly little stuff. So that brings me to the point. So what should a lab consist of? As I mentioned, you definitely need to record your test sessions, and I mentioned doing audio recordings, but at a bare minimum, you just need whatever it is that you're testing. It could be a hardware product, it could be an object, it could be whatever. And then you just need some way to record it, and that's it. So for most people in most environments, this would be a laptop with either the software that you're developing or an actual working prototype, and possibly a video camera or some sort of screen recording software. There is lots of software out there for recording test sessions on the computer. The standard application, at least from a few years ago that I recall, is a program called Moray, Moray. Who makes it? I think it's a company called TechSmith. I think they make Camtasia and all that other stuff. But last that I checked, when I was setting up a usability lab and establishing sort of this UX process, the Moray setup was going to run probably like 1500 for a complete software suite, not to mention the actual hardware you need to run both the observer setup and the recorder, and like it was just a lot of equipment, and quite frankly, it felt kind of extraneous, like too much like hardware. I would say if you're like a more developed company where you can afford a lot of this kind of expensive equipment, then by all means get a Moray setup. But what we did end up using was an application called Silverback. Highly recommend Silverback. At the time that I purchased it, I think it was around $40. It's recorded the screen on the Mac And it's just simple enough to do absolutely just what you need and nothing that you don't. There's a lot of like other features that Mori has that kind of make it a little more, I don't know, nice, where you can like annotate things like while the test is happening at certain time segments or whatever. But I think even Silverback does that now. Anyway, Silverback is very simple. It's called Silverback because they use it for gorilla usability testing. And I mean like not like testing gorillas, but like like gorilla, like GUER gorilla. Anyways, Silverback is good. I highly recommend that one. And it's made by some small company in the UK, so it's nice to support the little guys too. But in reality though, you don't even really need to have these kind of screen recorders and applications like this, because in a pinch, a video camera can basically do the same thing. And also having a video camera opens up to other kinds of tests that you may not be able to do, especially if your products are not just sort of screen-based products. Having a video camera around is really helpful. Or even for doing like just sort of lo-fi internal testing, it's good to just have a video camera around. Anyways, I digress. You don't really need the applications, but they are nice to use if you can afford the expense. As I mentioned, Silverback was $40. It might be 60 now. A whole $20 more. So, if you can spare it, Silverback is definitely the affordable solution. So moving on, to actually run a test, you'll need to prep a bunch of things in advance. So first, what you'll need is whatever it is that you're going to test, of course. And as I mentioned a couple times already, the thing that you're going to test can really be anything. It can be a software prototype, an actual software application, meaning something that's live and in a box or whatever, digital download, whatever, the actual product. It can be a physical product like a coffee maker or a shopping cart or a basketball. But really, truly, anything can be tested doing usability testing. A former design director that I worked with once, he described to me an interesting project that he wanted to do around usability testing the highway system and how people use, drive on and off highways, and how the usability of the interstates could actually be improved. So there's even things like that that you can do. It doesn't actually require having software for this kind of stuff. So once you have the thing that you're going to test, the next thing you'll need is to figure out the task list that you want the participants to do. As a general rule of thumb, I allocate around 5 minutes per task, and generally try not to do more than 10 tasks per test. Did you follow that? 5 minutes. So the general rule of thumb is to budget 5 minutes per task. It generally, runs longer, sometimes it runs shorter. So 5 minutes is just a good rule of thumb that I use. And no more than 10 tasks per test. Why is that? Because 10 times 5 is 50, right? So you're already at close to an hour there, and there's all kinds of other stuff that you'll need to do in running the test that would push it longer than an hour if you did all 10. Anyways, this is not to say that you couldn't have like 25 tasks. There's nothing wrong with having an extremely long task list. But just bear in mind that the longer your task list is, means the longer that you'll need to keep someone in your lab doing the test. And there are lots of reasons not to keep them longer than an hour. Unless your test, for whatever reason, requires that, they need to be there for like 3 hours doing a usability study or whatever. But generally, an hour, you kind of want to keep people only for an hour. It gets tiring after, an hour and a half or so. I've gone through tests where they ended up being like an hour and a half. And it can be exhausting after that. When you start getting, hour 45, like as a facilitator, you get tired, and I would imagine even the participant gets tired. Anyways, So those are my general rule of thumb, but of course you can always change it as you need to. Developing a task list should also be fairly easy because by the time that you've got a prototype, you should already, or if you're testing the actual product, you should already have identified some of the more critical use cases that surround the product that you're developing. And even if not, if you haven't identified those things yet, it's okay because you can use the task list as the way to identify what use cases are really critical and then evaluate those, right? So basically start with kind of the main use cases is probably, and it's probably not more than five, right? Maybe two or three main use cases, and really zero in on what are those really key behaviors that your user base exhibits and write all that stuff down. And I bet after you do that, maybe you end up with 5 to 6 critical tasks that, you know, must be completed with your product, and probably a much larger array of just like random, like one-off stuff. And that's totally fine. You can just focus in on like the handful of stuff, and you keep, you know, maybe 2 or 3 tasks in reserve just in case there's more time or whatever. But as long as you cover like the key points, that should be good enough, right? Additionally to the task list, you'll need to also develop a testing script. You develop this script to help ensure that you are administering the test in the same way with each participant. And this is extremely important, okay? I know people have, like, I've worked places where they ask me, why are you writing a script? Don't waste your time on that. And I had to explain to them that, you know, if we don't run the tests in the exact same way every time, it means that the results we get back are going to be inconsistent and therefore unreliable, right? So it's part of your sort of testing ethics to make sure that how you run the test as a facilitator is consistent, right? If you continue to, like, basically, if you vary your test method every single participant, you're going to get data that basically cannot be compared. And then at that point, it's like, well, what the hell is the point of testing at all? So don't do that. Develop a script. Follow your script. You'll be fine. Additionally, so the task list is simply just a rundown of all the things that need to be covered in the test, but the testing script is going to cover exactly the language that you use when you introduce a task, okay? And so as a result, the questions that you ask should not lead the user to the solution. You never want to ask leading questions. This is another key point in the testing process. For the exact same reason that you want to have a script, you need to ask these questions in a more open-ended way so that it gives the user the time to think and use the product to solve whatever this problem is. If you lead them to the answer through your task, then your test results are invalid, right? Because you just gave them the solution. So what do I mean by this, right? So what would be an example of a leading question? So let's say you were testing... what's a good example? Let's say you're testing iOS, okay? And, you know, you put them in an app and you wanted them to get back to the home screen, okay? Well, if your testing script says, now, how do you exit the app and go back to the home screen? That could be somewhat of a leading question because there's a button that, you know, sort of commonly known as the home button. Another way to phrase it that wouldn't necessarily lead them to the answer would be something like, how would you exit this application? Or you describe the scenario. You've been using this app for a little while. You're done with it. How would you leave this application? Right? It doesn't talk about going home or whatever, but, you know, the idea is that they need to use the thing that you're testing in order to solve this problem. by asking more open-ended questions, it actually gives them the opportunity to provide you the feedback that you need, right? Because if you just direct them to the answer, they're just going to do what you said, and that's not really feedback, right? And the other part of this is that you're not really grading the user on how they do. It's not evaluating them and how good they are. What you're doing is you're grading the product on how easy it is for this type of user. So by directing them to the answer, you're just saying, our product is great, you know, just use it. That's not useful, right? So this leads me to myth number 4, which is we should respond iteratively to each participant's feedback. And I want to say, never do this, okay? You're running a test of X number of participants, and I've been in a situation where the product manager was very trigger happy, and he wanted to change the prototype after every single test participant that came into the office, okay? Never do this. Never, 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 never do this, okay? Why? Because in this particular case, this PM thought that the feedback of a single individual equates to the feedback from an entire market segment. Does that sound ludicrous to you? It does to me. But what I'm getting at is if you change your prototype between every single participant, not only is your testing method inconsistent, but you also run a gigantic risk of iterating away from the actual problem you intend to solve. Because everyone is going to have a slightly different take on the solution. They're going to have a slightly different perception, a slightly different interpretation of what they're seeing. And if you tailor your solution every single time to that one person's thing, it doesn't mean after all those different people you'll have a great product. It means what you'll have at the end of it is a schizophrenic product. And that's a dumb thing to do. So don't do it. Instead, be disciplined enough to have the patience to wait till the test is over before figuring out how to respond to the feedback. That's how you deal with test results. Okay? That's all I'm going to say. So now that you've prepped everything you need, I mean, there's a little more stuff, like you'll need to develop a recruiting plan and all that kind of stuff. But anyways, once you develop the stuff that you need to do is you'll need to start recruiting. Maybe you do this also asynchronously rather than more in parallel than in serial. But you need to start recruiting at some point. So in order to recruit, what will you need to know? You'll need to know who your target user is. There are many companies, when you ask them who your target user is, their response is, anybody that's willing to pay for my product. That is not a target user, right? A target user is something like, we're interested in people who play video games, are aged 18 to 24, they go to college full time, they have a part-time job to afford video games. That's a target user. You can actually recruit against that. The other one, the anybody willing to pay for a product, is not a target user because you don't know who that is. Is it a guy? Is it a girl? Is it a minority group? Is it a whatever? Is it people in America? Is it in, you know, people in Asia? Is it people in Greenland? Like, how do you define this? So I would think a company that defines their target user as that probably also has a number of other issues. So that might be an interview question if you wanted to ask somebody. Anyways. But anyways, hopefully you have defined personas as part of your design process. And if so, just pick the ones that you need to involve as part of the test. But if you have multiple personas that are fairly different from each other, just make sure to recruit the right number of participants for each persona, right? So if you haven't picked personas, we'll talk about how many participants to get later. So don't worry, I'm going to get into that. But if you haven't picked out personas yet, now is definitely a good time to do it because you need to recruit against them. Like I said, you want to be specific enough to be able to target a particular type of demographic. and it's okay to be choosy. Saying anybody who's willing to buy our product is not being specific enough, it's not being selective enough, and you cannot possibly design a good product that way. And so you have to be somewhat selective. Who is it actually for? Why do they need something like this? Those sorts of questions. As another sort of component to the recruiting thing, you will need to compensate people for their time. So anytime somebody comes into your office or comes into your lab for participating in a usability test, you will need to compensate them somehow because they are going to be spending at least an hour with you sharing their insights. And it's just good test ethics. As a testing person, you are ethically obligated to uphold this standard of compensating people for their time. What the compensation is and how you compensate them is totally up to you. I have given out gift cards. I have been involved in cash transactions. I have been involved with, you know, movie tickets or free coffee or what have you. Compensation can take different forms depending on the type of testing you're doing. If you're doing sort of, you know, sort of seat of the pants, like informal, really loose testing inside your office, you know, maybe you just get people some goofy little toys so that they feel like they got something out of their time, right? But if you're actually dealing with customers, you'll want to compensate them somehow. Do be aware, though, that there are people out there looking to earn cash and not really offer much feedback. Even with things like gift cards and stuff like that, you know, there's just people out there that, you know, they want to do these tests so they can get something for free. And then they come in, they don't really say much during the test. And they generally say stuff like, oh, yeah, it was pretty good. I thought it was fine. Even though, like, you know, they really aren't helping you answer any questions or whatever. So be on the lookout for that kind of stuff. It does happen that you get those kinds of people in from time to time. It happens. But hopefully your screening methods are good enough to weed those kinds of people out. So earlier I mentioned, you know, how many people to bring in. In general, I like to try and bring in 6 to 8 people per test. Or, you know, if it's multiple personas per test, then 6 to 8 of each persona. This leads me to the next myth number 5, which is, you need a statistically significant number of participants. So for people who have never experienced usability testing before, they'll be totally astounded and completely unimpressed that you're basing highly important decisions based on the responses of 6 to 8 people. That never changes. Okay? It's especially true of people who have never seen or been a participant or observed any of this kind of testing before. Because they took some sort of college statistics course and, you know, they probably didn't pay attention too much in it. And so they mistakenly assume that for any given study, as long as it's called a study, you need to get thousands upon millions of people's feedback in order to really make sound decisions, and that doing anything less than that is simply not viable, and therefore your test is invalid because you didn't recruit 10 billion people from your target market. The simple answer to that question, well, that really wasn't a question, but the simple answer is that 6 to 8 people in a usability study, highly emphasized usability study, but 6 to 8 people in a usability study is statistically significant. It is certainly true for certain kinds of studies like a survey or a poll, you know, the kinds of studies where the goal is to quantify a large sample, right? Where the intention is to get a large number of people and then say, here's quantitatively our results, which is why you should probably not trust too many polls because they don't actually survey that many people, especially CNN. Just kidding. But for those kinds of things, sure, you want to get tens upon millions of people. And 6 to 8 is just not going to be sufficient, right? Our poll covered 8 people, and 90% of them said heroin is good for you. Right? Like, that's not, probably not the right kind of statistical significance that you're looking for. Okay? But usability testing, usability studies, they are not the same as a survey. They are not the same as those types of studies. And anyone who believes you need more than 6 to 8 people is mostly wrong. Usability testing is a very particular type of research. And it's been proven time and again that more participants does not equal more insights. Usability testing suffers from the phenomenon known as diminishing returns. Jacob Nielsen, foremost expert on this kind of stuff, over many decades of testing, has identified that the number of new learnings from participants actually starts to flatten out after around 6 people. So what does that mean? For any given test, you uncover the vast majority of the important problems after your first 6 participants. And then to spend the effort to uncover the remaining, 80-20 rule, so maybe the remaining 20% of the problems, you would need to get a significant effort, far, far more than what it's worth, to cover 100% of the problems. So 6 to cover the critical majority, maybe 40 or so, I would guess, to cover the remaining 20%. As I mentioned, I was a observer in a large-scale study. It was like around 20-something participants. Like literally after the 10th person, we'd heard just about everything we needed to hear, because the first 6 to 8 covered most of the vast majority of the problems. So participant 11 to 24 was basically reiterating exactly the same things that the first 6 to 8 people were saying. And it was like, why are we doing this? After number 17 or so, we were like, why are we still testing? We're not getting anything else. We found maybe like 1 or 2 additional things for the remaining, 14 people. But it really wasn't worth the expense of compensating them for it. It wasn't worth the expense of paying all these people to observe the test. And the physical exhaustion of running the same test 24 times, it was not worth it. The only reason why I suggest getting 8 and not just 6, I mean, 6 is the bare minimum, but I actually think 8 is a good number to get, because it just happens that a couple people may just randomly drop out, right? They just may not show up. They decide that it's not worth it to them to show up, and they don't tell you. And so you have them scheduled for a time, you confirm the time with them, and they just don't show up. And so it's good just to cover yourself in that way, that way you don't have to scramble to sort of recruit more people. You recruit more than what you need, basically, and I think 8 is sufficient. And if, let's say, hypothetically, all 8 show up, great. You can just confirm some of the insights from the first 6 with the last 2, and you sort of have a little bit more test coverage. Okay, so now comes the day when you actually run the test. So some things. Make sure that you have your scripts ready. Make sure that you practice what I like to call your bedside manner. As a test facilitator, you have to be able to talk in a way that helps put the participants at ease, and it's all about how you deliver it. You want to make sure you're asking non-leading questions, things like that. So practice. It takes practice. And I would actually recommend also doing some dry runs of your test, because sometimes it takes a little time to iron out the kinks in what you're doing. Have a stopwatch or a clock or some kind of timer with you so that you can note down the times when the user has completed tasks, or has said something kind of important, or has done something kind of significant that you want to refer back to later on. It's very important to do that. And noting the time can help you know how long something might have taken. And also, basically, it will help you find it later in your recordings. As I mentioned, you want to do some dry runs, so, you know, test your setup well in advance. Things like iron out the kinks in your prototype. You don't want to have to, like, debug a product in the middle of a test. That's really embarrassing. Doing dry runs, as I mentioned, is also good. You want to be able to make sure your test sort of has a flow to it. If it's all kind of disjointed, it just can be kind of, like, confusing to do, so you want to smooth those things out. Maybe you find out that you need to adjust your task list a little bit also. So definitely it helps doing a dry run or two. And then the rest is basically just running the test and collecting your feedback. So a couple more things that I want to mention about that before we close out on this section. So some other things to mention about this. Make sure you assign someone to take notes. Okay, if you're the facilitator, it can be really tough to take notes at the same time as helping somebody deal with the test. Yes, you will have the recordings, of course, that you can refer back to, but it's just good to have somebody take notes in the meantime so that they can sort of just note down significant things. Generally, it's better to have a designer or somebody that's like a usability-trained person to write things down. In a pinch, you can get a PM or an engineer. Just make sure that they're aware of the things that they need to note down, because good note taking is also a highly important skill, and if they mess it up, it's really kind of not that helpful, right? It's a waste of people's time. Also, and this is really important, it's kind of boring, but after your test is done, it's really important to take some time and write up your findings and recommendations. Basically, write a report. And writing a report is, I am going to say it right now, writing a report is super boring. Okay? But if you don't write a report, anybody that joins your team or joins your company somewhere down the road, they won't be able to learn from what you guys have done. Okay? And I was actually once asked to stop writing reports. Why are you wasting time writing reports? And I explained this to them that, you know, yes, we can forego the report writing, but what if we need to refer back to something we found out, right? It's important for just documenting things and being thorough to write things down so that you can share this knowledge. I mean, I am a strong proponent that things are not knowledge until you can write them down. The act of writing something down transforms any kind of learning into knowledge. And it's this act of writing it down. The reason why I say it's knowledge is because it's actually something you can then share, right? The fact that you can share some learning with somebody is spreading knowledge around. So writing things down is not it's kind of boring, but it's important. It's an important task. So make sure you do it. And as I mentioned, you know, I was asked to not write them once, but sure enough, when I hired some more designers, they actually could benefit from the fact that I wrote down all the reports and wrote down all the findings and was very thorough about, you know, explaining the test methods and things like that. And the new hires actually benefited. They could come up to speed quicker on projects because there was information that they could refer to. So definitely do it, okay? So that's it in terms of just running tests. I have a couple more things I want to get into now. So the big question is, when do I run what kinds of tests? This is probably oft asked question, is that even right? This question gets asked a lot by people who've never really done this kind of stuff before and are not really sure what to do. So to answer this question, let's actually describe a few scenarios, okay? So let's say you are a new designer in a company, and you're asked to start developing a brand new product that nobody in the company has ever worked on before. And so you have this opportunity to start using usability testing as part of the design process. So in this type of scenario, you can actually use testing to help develop some of this institutional knowledge on this subject matter, right? Especially in the case where nobody really has any experience that you can refer to, you can build up that kind of knowledge by using testing. And I recently wrote a blog post on this topic, actually, that I called the minimum viable prototype, and I'll link it in the article so that you have a chance to read it. But the idea is, instead of designing 2D images, right? This is what we do as designers. We design mockups, and those are generally the artifacts that we use to talk about design. But in software, in interactive media, what people interact with is actually not just 2D screens. There's this dimension, there's a fourth dimension of time that you have that you can play around with. And interaction design really needs to have prototypes. It needs to be a prototyping type of process, because in order to understand the interaction of a system, you need to be able to design interactions. And you can't do that simply by looking at screens. You can sort of talk about screen layouts and stuff, but until you really get into the details of how something actually interacts, it's very hard. And so what this process is around minimum viable prototype is, yeah, you create wireframes and mockups as fast as you can with as little effort as you can put into them, within reason. But the main deliverable is a prototype, some sort of either low fidelity prototype, paper prototype, or what have you. And then simply just start testing as fast as you can, right? And as often as you can. The whole goal of it would be to iterate the design using customer feedback as the thing that drives the iteration. It's sort of like, you know, lean startup type stuff, but instead of actually going through the expense of developing a product and releasing it, you can actually gain a lot more insights by running them as usability tests. And in this way, you can build up learning, you can build up knowledge, and really make learning and failure a critical part of how the software or this whatever product actually gets developed. So that's how it account for that scenario. This leads to myth number 6, which is usability testing takes a long time. We don't have time to do it. To that, I say yes. Generally, it can. Even doing it solo, so I've run tests solo from end to end, meaning starting from zero to the completed report. I was able to do it in 6 weeks by myself. With help, with a team, I could actually get that down to, you know, 3 or 4 weeks or so. But to be honest with you, the only way you can speed it up is actually through repetition. You practice something enough times that eventually become good at it. You become proficient at it, and it becomes more of a reflex, and so you become faster. This is why people have this idea that usability testing takes a long time, is because they do it like once a year. And every time they sit down to do it, they think, what are all these things that I have to do? And they don't remember, and they have to figure it all out. And so the only way to get faster is to basically, like in sports, you drill, repeat, you do things over and over again until you get it right. And probably one of the parts that take the longest is the recruiting part. Now, the flip side of that is what people will say is, well, we can get an A/B test out really fast. And yes, that's possible. But let's think about that for a second. In order to get the kinds of usability, the insights you will gain from a usability test, just think how many A/B tests you'd have to run. Because what do you actually learn from A/B tests, right? If you're testing, say, like, why is something difficult to use? Let's A/B test it. So you'd have to come up with lots of different variations of things that you think are easy to use. and build those things, put them into the tests, let the test run for what, a week or so, look at the results, analyze the results, iterate, put another test out, what have you. And what do you really learn, right? What does a button click count actually tell you? The fact that 30% more people clicked a button, does that really mean it's easy? I mean, how do you know? That's the general question, right? If you look at two numbers and say one is higher, one is lower, does that mean you made something easy? I don't know how to answer that question, right? Versus running a usability test where you can simply just ask somebody, you can ask them a question. How was it to use? Was it easy? Did it feel easy to use? Did you like using it? So really, end to end, how long and how many A/B tests are we talking about before you can get to the insights, the kinds of insights that you'll gain from running one test? And is running A/B tests like that even worth it? There's a monetary cost, right? If you're using things like Optimizely, you know, maybe you're spending like 2 months running A/B tests to try and understand why something is difficult to use. You may get there. I'm not saying you can't. You may get there, but your chances are much lower. Whereas you run one usability test, sure, it may take, you know, 4 weeks or 6 weeks, but you know you're going to get the answers. So why not do it? Okay, next scenario. So let's say you are a new designer in a company, but unlike the previous scenario, you're actually asked to redesign an existing product that is just not performing very well. So in this scenario, you actually have a few different options, okay? You could just do a quick heuristic evaluation and just to get some quick answers, right? You may have to quickly put something out, right? Because they want to do an A/B test or whatever, right? So you could do some sort of heuristic evaluation to come up with recommendations and on what to fix. Okay. But another way to do this is to do what I call a benchmark usability test. And a benchmarking study is something that you do on a product that is currently being used and is live in the market. Okay. So you run the usability test on the existing product that's out there in the current version. Forget about whatever is being developed for now, because what you're trying to do is learn where is the product at today, right? The product that people are using today, how good or how bad is it? You may find, after doing a benchmarking study like this, that even though visually it looks bad, it might actually be serving customers fairly well in terms of usability. In which case, you can come up with, you know, visual design iterations and test those at a later date and really like not worry so much about usability or sort of the interaction design or the general user experience, right? It just sort of depends on what the results are. Another thing that can be helpful for running a benchmarking study is that as a new employee in a company, just doing the study itself can actually help you learn about the products that the company offers. Because you're going to have to learn use cases, you're going to have to develop personas, you're going to have to do all these things that are sort of user-centered design practices anyway. And so it's good to kind of do this based on what the product does today. You can learn about it. You can find these things out simply by doing the work. The last thing that's sort of good about this kind of stuff is that when you do the usability test on, say, a future redesign, the test results you got from the benchmarking study can actually be compared to the new results, because in general, the types of tasks that the existing product should be able to do are exactly the same for the new version of the product. I mean, unless you're testing some new features or whatever. But let's say you just redesigned the current product. the task should generally be the same. You should be testing kind of the same basic things that the user needs to be able to accomplish. And so in that way, you could sort of compare the results, and hopefully the new design is actually better than the old design. And so you'll be able to find that out by running a benchmarking study. In either of these scenarios, I would highly recommend that you test as you go. In general, my general sort of advice on this is to actually do 3 usability tests per major feature. So you do 1 very early on when you just have wireframes or sketches or, you know, paper prototypes or something like that. You do something very early. You do something sort of like mid to late on, you know, something that looks a little more real. So maybe you've solidified some of the visual design and solidified some of the interaction. And so you want to sort of test those out. And especially if you've done already 1 study on something early, you can sort of use the second test to sort of confirm all the findings that you got were actually good. And the third test that you run is post-release. So once you've done the first test, the second test on the sort of more faithful one, by that point you should have everything well in hand to do a release. You release, and you test the actual release software, because as we all know, things change. And so you kind of want to make sure that the stuff that did get changed doesn't have deleterious effects on the usability. But that can be a lot of work, and it may take a long time to get something out. So you may not be able to do all 3, but in an ideal scenario, that's what you'd want to do. Okay? This leads me to myth number 7, which is usability testing will show us what users want. Hopefully by now, you've realized that testing the usability of a product has absolutely nothing to do with defining what users want. I wrote this in a tweet one time that it really has nothing to do with what users want, right? If you need to figure out what users want, what sort of products users want, why they want certain things, you should go find that out. But don't run usability tests for that. And definitely don't run A/B tests for that. Instead, just interview people. You can just ask somebody. You, sir or madam, as a whatever type of user in whatever type of occupation, what are the kinds of things that make your job difficult? What would you like to have to make your job more easy? Though that's pretty much all you need to know. Then the question is, how do you build that? And then you build that, test the usability of that thing. By that point, because if you're testing the usability of something just to find out what somebody wants, that's a lot of work, right? To go through the process of defining use cases and developing a prototype and all that stuff, like, that's a lot of work. When all you could have done is ask somebody 2 or 3 questions, talk to people, get out of the office and go talk to somebody, you'll get that kind of information a lot easier. In the end, you know, a lot of the stuff you'll get out of usability testing are simply just insights that you can sort of quantify, because you'll have, if you did it right and followed my recommendations, you'll have tested everything in the same way. So you can quantify the insights that you've gained. But since you're just getting insights, it still takes a lot of smart people to develop the right plan of action based on the test findings you have. And make sure that you have also the right level of humility to accept that things in your product can and should change. As long as you can do that, you are golden. Okay, well, that's it for usability testing. Thanks so much for listening. I know it was kind of a long episode, a long rant about usability testing and myths and all that stuff. I very much appreciate you listening to me. If you do have any questions, feel free to get in touch. I will be hosting a chat session on Blab to discuss this stuff. If you have not signed up for Blab, Hopefully you will. I can link it in the show notes for this episode. And I definitely hope that you can join me there if you want to discuss this in more detail, or if you just have questions, like maybe I didn't answer something that is burning on the top of your mind. Maybe I can answer it. I don't know if I can. But if you miss the Blab Chat, I will definitely try to record it and make sure that it's available to people later on. As always, you can find this episode and all of our other episodes from the Design Review Podcast. They are available on the web at www.designreviewpodcast.com. We are also on this thing called iTunes. I don't know if you've heard of it. It's like, I don't know, it's like a music sort of service or something. Anyways, it's pretty cool. You should check it out if you haven't seen it. But just go on there, search for Design Review Podcast. We should be in there somewhere. So yeah. As always, you can reach me. The best way is probably on Twitter. My Twitter handle is @machinehuman. I'm sorry Jonathan couldn't make it today. He's just really busy with writing his book. But you can also tweet at Jonathan. He definitely likes to talk to people on Twitter. And he is available there at @designuxui. Also, we probably haven't mentioned this enough times, but the Twitter handle for the podcast is actually @dr_podcast. So now you basically have no excuses for not talking to us. We're generally good people, so, you know, if you have questions or, you know, just want to say hi or whatever, just find us on there. Okay, once again, thanks for listening. I had a good time talking about this. Hopefully you had a good time listening. And I will see you next time. Bye!